Okay, welcome to Extroverted Developer, number 8. I'm Jim Wallace.
Number 8?
Number 8. Yeah, this week we're going to talk a little bit about why we didn't have a podcast last week.
Right.
Because we have some really big announcements from CityMaps.
That's right.
Yeah. Basically, all last weekend was spent deploying our new site.
Right. I think we all got, you know, only single-digit hours of sleep all weekend.
And, the glory of startup world.
And then spent a good chunk of the rest of the week sick, probably as a result.
Yeah, and so that's why this podcast is a little late, is because that we were a bit sick after being up till 4 a.m. pretty much straight for the last weekend completely.
But it was worth it. We have some fantastic new products. Our mobile app got released, and a nice new design and general makeover on the front, on the
desktop. And some good new features in there too, with the list
stuff.
Making and whatnot.
And all
more to come
up on the back end, thanks to Jim.
Yeah, all cleaned up on the back end. New database technology in the back end. We upgraded from Postgres 8.4 to 9.0.
That's right.
And that sped everything up great. I got this great book called High Performance Postgres 9. And that is like one of the best, like this guy cares very deeply about databases and performance. He's talking about what the different file systems available in Unix and how they have their advantages and disadvantages because of journaling and how Postgres automatically journals. And so you need to turn journaling off on EXT3. And then it's just like an incredibly detailed. If you care about performance of your Postgres databases, that is the book. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Definitely.
I don't know. That's it.
We all ordered iPads this week. That was kind of the exciting day in the office on, what was it, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Yeah, this is where being a web developer really comes in handy because you understand how web servers save state because everybody hammered the Apple.com website and it just took it down. It collapsed under the pressure. I sort of wish we had traffic like that, right? I would love to have so much traffic that was like, oh, no.
Please. Actually started some small fights in the office too over, you know, some of us watching the announcements and other people being very upset at the consumerism of Apple and things like that. It got a little heated once or twice. We were like, oh, you know.
It did. There's a lot of, I'm not sure if our guests have noticed, but there's a lot of zealotry in computer programming.
Some people feel strongly about Apples and PCs and Macs and things. So, yes, there was a little bit of that, but,
But most people ordered new iPads.
Most people ordered new iPads, yes.
And the haters continue to hate.
Right. So my first tablet device, actually. I've never had a tablet before.
That's fun. You're going to like it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to enjoy it. I think it's finally reached a point where I can, you know, fully embrace
it. I'm really excited about all the vector tools that were showed off.
Yes.
But from, was it Adobe? No, it wasn't Adobe. It was the other one. The
Autodesk,
Sketchpad.
Yes. Sketchpad looks very cool.
Yeah, that'll be very good for you, I think, Ben.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't understand why people become so religious over basically arbitrary decisions in computing. I mean, this all goes back, like Mac versus PC, they were both computers, right?
Right.
You could surf the web. It doesn't matter. You use a web browser now to do most of your work anyway.
There are people who felt strongly about Amiga back when I was in college. So.
Yeah, and there are people who, I mean, Linux versus Windows. What are the other ones?
Right.
Like object-oriented versus functional programming and things like that. And it's just like, we can't even agree on the order of bits down in the operating. There's little endian and big endian. And guess what? They've got their advantages and disadvantages to whether or not the first bit is the most significant or the least significant. It's all about what you're trying to do with it.
And I feel like for a community comprised largely of people who should consider themselves scientists, that as long as you can prove that you can do the same work with either, then the distinction should be nominal, I think.
Yeah, it's really difficult for us to say one thing is better than a number when it really is that arbitrary. Like, do the bits go left to right or right to left, right? It's just arbitrary.
And most people don't even think about it in those terms. They're thinking on very high level of, you know, Apple is consumerist and I hate Steve Jobs or whatever. and that's usually where the hatred comes from. But, you know, which is why I think Jim and I like to talk about process so much, is because those are areas where you can actually prove that something has an effect, and you can And you can show.
You can, but it's very difficult to tease out one process from another. First off, you can't get two teams of software developers who are doing the project for the very first time, but are equivalent in all of their ways. They have an equal amount of experience and equal skill set of the developer. Right. There's no developer lab rat. Every project is unique. It's the first time you're doing it. And if it's not the first time you're doing it, then you're probably invalidating the study because you already know the pitfalls you're going to run into as you go further on. There's actually a really great book that I picked up after listening to the Stack Overflow podcast where they were on, called Making Software. And it is, I can't remember his name for the life of me, but every chapter of this book is a scientific study about software development. Like, what do we really know about software, including what do we know about test-driven development? What does the research and the data show? And the first five chapters of that book are all about data. How do you acquire data for software projects? Like, how do you get this information in order to digest it? How do you determine the quality of the data and the reliability of the data? And it's like all the statistical stuff that you have to consider when you're analyzing a software project that just makes it seem like an impossible task. And yet, they do wind up coming to some conclusions about things, even with this data, including the 10x programmer thing.
Right.
That there are people who vary in computer programming up to 10 times more than the worst.
And that's kind of what I'm talking about. Is you're never going to find someone who does a study on whether people are more productive on Macs versus PCs, right? That's not going to come out. That's not going to convince anyone of anything. Whereas a book that actually shows that, you know, one process is better than another, that, you know, certain kinds of team structures or methodologies work better than another, you know, could actually change how people work.
It could, but it won't.
Apple isn't going to. No, I think it's changed how you thought that, you know.
Yeah, I think considering that we are a discipline that comes from science, I don't think necessarily what we do is science, right? We don't have a hypothesis and then go test it.
Right.
Even in computer science, right? Like, well, maybe. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm an engineer. I'm a computer engineer by training. And so I won't speak for computer scientists. But I don't think what we do here at CityMaps is science. And yet our discipline comes from science, just like other mechanical engineering sort of comes from physics. But I don't think, I am surprised by the lack of scientific thinking that comes out of our discipline, right?
Yeah, totally agree.
And we have tons of dogma about, oh, test-driven development is better. Well, prove it. Where's the data? Right. Where's your hypothesis? What are you disproving?
And you have to embrace at least the basic principles of science to be an engineer. You have to understand that, you know, you can't have preformed opinions about how your tests should turn out, or else they won't be valid tests, right? You can't say, well, you know, all my, you know, I firmly believe that this bridge should not fall down. But the data shows.
Yes, that would be interesting. So I'm always surprised.
Has no place.
Right, and dude, yet right. Flame Wars constantly, right? Slashdot is the classic thing, and yeah, I don't understand it. I am happy that books like Eric Ries's Lean Startup are coming out, where they're trying to get people, both technology people and business people, to use more scientific thinking, right? To actually have, don't go, I want this feature because I feel like I want this feature. How about put in this feature and see if it works, right? Like, how can we validate that this is a useful feature? Yep. You can only do that by putting it out there and testing it, like in an A/B test scenario for web pages. I'm not too sure how you do it with a mobile app, but it would be nice if you could put out two versions of the same one in the iOS. That'd probably be a problem though with Apple's rules.
Right. Focus groups even are, you know, they're not bad. It's a collection of anecdotes, but you collect enough of them.
But you've said time and again that
the plural of anecdote is not data.
Right.
But that's not to say that focus groups aren't valuable or that the opinions of your users aren't valuable. It, we call them user stories because, you know, the stories they tell us inform how they feel about the product. Because so much of a product is, you know, kind of this mushy feeling, very definitively not science sort of thing.
Yeah.
But
Right, but even with the mushy feeling, you can see what people actually do. Do they actually click on the button that we intended them to click on, right? We've got right. this giant download from the App Store button on our website. And is the placement of that there better than if it was on the top left? Right, those are the questions you right. can ask, and you can get real data about whether the button placement is correct by testing it.
That's true.
Right. Right now we do have like, but it looks so nice there from the bottom left. And maybe it's actually better there in the bottom left as well. But I don't know. Right now
and
it just feels nice.
Microcopying, making sure that something says, you know, a button says submit instead of okay or go or what, you know, even mm-hmm. little things like that can affect, you know, the user experience. And you know, you can only hits and number of clicks only have so much importance, right? Like, mm-hmm. if a newspaper discovers that by writing their headlines in a certain way, more people will click on them.
you're making a great point. Like, there's definitely clickbait, right? Yeah. And headlines. And so,
but that's, I don't know, that's starting to delve into kind of dark patterns and things that we've discovered that we've discussed in the past. But
yeah, actually, I would love to have a psychology show. I'm very obsessed with human decision making, and I've read a bunch of books on human decision making and done, and given a couple of presentations about it. And what Ben is essentially alluding to is that there's bugs in the human brain. Right. The most common of which is the optical illusion, right? We're all very familiar with optical illusions. And it's like, you look at these two things and they're the same size, but for some reason they look different based on the way that they're presented to you. And then you turn your head to the right and you look back at the image and it's as if you've learned nothing. It still looks like they're two different sizes. And yet, you know, logically that they're not. Those bugs, that is a bug in the visual processing cortex. Well, it turns out that we have logical bugs too. If choices are presented to us in a certain way, we will make the wrong one, or we will do something that may not be optimal every single time.
Right. Like the organ donation problem where people tend to...
Where it's opt-in, right? Exactly. Yeah. They just default.
Right.
And you so that's take... a prequel to a future show about psychology. But that's...
Yes, I'd love to do. We'll definitely be bringing in some user experience people and talking to them about some of these patterns in the future and how they can be exploited for good and evil.
Right, especially gamification and Skinner box yes. techniques.
Right.
All right, what's next?
So I found this isn't really a tip or anything, but I found an interesting site that I was showing Jim today called ninjablocks.com. It's actually very, very similar in concept to... something that's been floating around for the last year or so called If This Then That, IFTTT.com, and we'll put both of those in the show notes. But essentially, the idea behind both of them is that there's a lot of publicly available APIs out there and that you can hook into, and if you had a kind of some sort of central cloud-based solution that would let you hook one into the other with, you know, just by... Basically, kind of like Linux allows you to pipe output from one thing into another mm-hmm. thing. You can say, well...
in fact, Yahoo has a product called Pipes.
Right.
That is exactly this as well.
So if a tweet with an image in it shows up in my Twitter feed, then save that image to Dropbox, right?
Mm-hmm.
Little use cases like that. NinjaBlocks takes that one step further and essentially gives you a number of little blocks, I guess, for what they call them, and these each have a collection of sensors in them or attached to them, like a camera or a button or a temperature sensor or an accelerator. And when they get input of a certain kind, then they'll hook into an API and say, like, if I detect motion outside my window with this camera, then take a picture and upload it to Facebook or
mm-hmm.
Drop it in a Dropbox or whatever. That kind of started us on this conversation about rules-based engines, right? Like how like the things I would want to do with that, and I haven't had access to the API or anything yet, but I'm pretty sure that I would probably run out of space
the past.
Pretty quickly, right?
I mean, yeah, and we've built rules engines in the past because every single client that I've ever had, and especially traders, they're like, what I want is a simple way to either filter the data or right. order it in some way or group it. And suddenly they want filtering, ordering, and group by. And I'm like, why not just learn SQL?
Yeah.
Right? Just learn SQL, because there's already a language that's out there that's been debugged and been tuned for performance yep. that will do this.
You're like, but I want it to be simple.
Right, but I want it to be simple, but I want you to do it by yourself. I want you to create an entire language by yourself right. Without the budget of a language company like Microsoft. Do you know how many people are on the VB team? It's a lot.
Maybe the appropriate response when someone says that is say, all right, well, you spec the language and I'll write it for you.
Maybe.
But you bring me the full grammar and,
Yeah, but they don't even know what you're talking about at that point, right? It's just like,
maybe not.
I've been asked this a billion times, like traders, they're like, can't we just get a thing that turns green when it's time for me to make a trade? And they don't seem to understand that if I could detect when it was time to make a trade, I could make the trade without you pushing right. the button. Yes.
I wouldn't be working for you.
Right.
I could do that, yes. But.
And so these rules engines are always like doomed to failure. We need to filter and sort and group all of this information over and over again. And so many programmers are wasting so many CPU cycles essentially trying to create SQL, but easier. And because it's never just if this, then that. It's if this, then that, except if this, or when that's happening, right? And then eventually it just becomes so complicated. I'm like, why not just use Python?
Or gets fuzzy, like if this looks like that, or if, right.
Right, and then they can't specify it correctly. What everybody wants is they want the host. They want to see all of the data so that they can see if they can see a pattern, right? And they want tools to help them find patterns. But once they've found the pattern, then they'll tell you, oh, right, this is the logic. Right, it's like whenever this flag goes up and that thing goes down, then this. They don't know the rules to the specificity, and so they want you to create a generic rules engine.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
Right. So many terrible ideas are started with "Can't you just dot dot dot?"
Yeah, and then it's just oh, but what if I want them to group, right? And they just add features and add you features.
And then they hate it once it's built.
Because it's super complicated. Because,
yeah,
it's not
either super complicated or it doesn't do exactly what they want. And it's in this perpetual state of being changed. And that doesn't work for a language either. Just ask JavaScript.
Oh, JavaScript. That's all I had to say about rules engines. Let's stop building them. Let's just teach people to program.
I agree. Yes. Amen.
Do they actually make them easier? I know that Martin Fowler is big on domain-specific languages. He thinks that it can help us communicate with our business partners better by speaking in a common vocabulary and actually making a language for the computer that says the rules of what the computer should do in the business's language. Right. So you don't write them in C. You write a parser for your domain-specific language that can translate into C.
Procter & Gamble is very big on this.
They have
not exactly a language, but they certainly have invented words, not necessarily invented words, but have assigned new meanings to words that have certain business contexts, right? And they'll use them in certain ways.
That's something that's sort of great about English as a language. We have someone here. We can redefine words and come up with a meaning. Some people in the office don't like words, like audiophile. Right. And I'm just like, yes, instead of having this one word that has a common meaning between all of us, so we can just say, oh, I'm an audiophile, and we all know exactly what that means. Let me instead tell you every time I describe myself that I like music a lot. I love like music so much to the point that I love it and that I care very deeply about music. Let me say that whole sentence every time I want to describe me and other people like me. I am not an audiophile, but...
Right. But the fact that you can take in a whole idea and assign a symbol to it and then...
And then a reason about that symbol, exactly. That's part of why English is so powerful and Chinese as well. And that's why they're going to be the only two languages left in the future of Firefly.
Yes. Well, I think that's the key to communication in business as well, is to come up with common words that everyone understands. That I mean, I haven't studied Martin Fowler as you have, but
I'm talking about like two blog posts that I read.
Okay.
But he is actually one of the most influential bloggers, at least, and he's an author and he speaks and things like that, but. And his AB architecture thing, for deployments, that's where I sold that from him too.
we had this conversation earlier, a little argument between a couple of the developers earlier about what to call a desktop browser web application. Do you call it your desktop web app as opposed to your mobile web app? You can't just say mobile because mobile could mean native mobile or...
Or a web mobile, right?
And, and their argument was, well, you can't say the word desktop because, for one, that, you know...
Eliminates laptop users?
But I think desktop to some people means a application that runs on Windows or on Mac, right?
It's a native desktop app.
It doesn't run in the browser. And so, and they were like, well, it's just a web app. And we're like, well, then what's a mobile web, like, you know?
I think they say mobile web app. So we have web apps, we have desktop apps, mobile web apps, mobile apps.
Can you say desktop web app?
Can you say a desktop web app?
If you're trying to, you know.
You have to somehow denote that it's in the browser.
Right. And we didn't come to a good resolution on that. It was just sort of...
What's your thought?
I generally say desktop web app.
Desktop web app. You combine the two.
Right. If I'm being specific, in some cases your web app is just your web app. If it's got like responsive design, it just depends on the size of the browser you're opening it in. You know, that's the best of all worlds. But if you've got two separate applications, for example,
that are both on the web,
we have a mobile branch and we have a branch, right? We have a trunk branch, or, you know, whatever we want to call our primary, our, you know, web facing application. So,
all right, yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know if there's a good solution to that, but I tend to call it desktop application. But I mean, that's just, you know, another example of how people take different words to mean different things, even for very simple use cases. And imagine how much worse this gets when you take this language problem and extrapolate it over things that are actually really hard to explain.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, that's why we have domain, or that's his whole point about domain-specific language, is coming up with a common vocabulary so that you can express ideas congruently together. And some thoughts you can't even have without, let's not go into that. We'll go into that later when, in the psychology show. We'll talk about words.
Everyone seemed to get sick all at the same time.
Oh, yeah, that was sad.
I think that's one of the downsides of having an open office plan is when a few people's immune systems take a hit, then everyone gets sick.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the closed office camp. Yes. This is just like adding ammunition, like another nail in the coffin for me being okay with the open office environment.
Right.
Maybe it's because I'm such a social person. I want to always be involved in everybody's conversations. It's very difficult for me to concentrate.
It's actually better for me if I can close the door, because then I don't get distracted. Because I tend to be distracted pretty easily by things that are going on. And even with headphones in, sometimes you'll catch a snippet of loud conversation that'll be interesting or sound like something you should be paying attention to. So I'll, you know, take one earbud out and be like, oh, were you guys talking about, you know, something I need to... And it gets off the rails very quickly.
Especially when you just have a long problem, you're like, this problem is going to be hard. It's going to take me several hours to come up with the algorithm or to test and do all this stuff. I just need a solid stretch of quiet. Like, I don't see what's so wrong with that. And yet, in today, we're very much shunning offices and cubicles and things. We're all about open floor plans. And I bet there is, in fact, data about that in the book, and I haven't finished it. I need to finish that.
There are things to recommend open office plans as well. I mean, there is kind of like a family atmosphere. I think people tend to be closer when they kind of eat together or hang out together on a more regular basis.
Yeah, I'm all for lunch together.
Yeah.
where you get that camaraderie and then back to your own offices.